The title of this session is Looking On From Afar, Women in the Gospel of Matthew. And this is the second in our series of talks about women in the four Gospels. My name is Christine Carlson. We looked yesterday at women in the Gospel of Mark and learned a few things about them. Today, when I talk about Matthew, I will sometimes be referring to Mark by way of comparison. And I find that that helps us then seeing the differences and the similarities between these two stories, Matthew's and Mark's, helps us get a handle on what unique things perhaps Matthew is doing. So to begin, I'd like us to go back to Mark, to the first chapter, the first verse. And we'll look at that first as a way into Matthew then. Mark begins the gospel in the first chapter with this phrase. It's not really a sentence. It's not a complete sentence. I think of it more as the title of the gospel, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. And there are a couple things to note about that first verse in the gospel of Mark. First of all is the first word, the beginning. That is a word that perhaps echoes back in our minds when we hear it to the first word in the book of Genesis. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. Maybe Mark is, by use of that first word in this gospel, echoing the beginning of Genesis, drawing some continuity between those two books, saying that as Genesis, the beginning of creation, was one of beginning, so this also is a beginning. But that word also signals a difference, a discontinuity in Mark. Genesis tells about the beginning of creation, one beginning. This is another beginning in Jesus Christ, the Son of God. And that's one of the themes that we didn't look at so much yesterday in Mark, but this theme of continuity, but also discontinuity that Mark develops. It's emphasized, and I'll just point this out briefly, in the first event that we find in the Gospel of Mark, the baptism of Jesus. What happens when Jesus is baptized and comes up out of the water? We find in verse 10, and when he came up out of the water, immediately he saw the heavens opened and the Spirit descending upon him like a dove. That verb opened is a weak English translation of the Greek verb. And in Greek it's schizo, S-C-H-I-Z-O, like in our words for schizophrenic. And it means to tear, like a piece of cloth would be torn. And there's almost a violent connotation to the tearing that it happens in the heavens when Jesus is baptized. And that undergirds this theme of discontinuity that we find in the Gospel of Mark and that's developed in the Gospel. This story that Mark is telling has a continuity with what's come before, but this is also a new thing that Jesus is doing now, this one Jesus the Christ. And as the heavens tear open when Jesus is baptized, so the world is going to be torn open because of this one Jesus. That's Mark's themes. In contrast to that, we find what is happening in Matthew. Let's turn to the first chapter, the first verse in Matthew, and see how Matthew begins this gospel. Again, it's not a complete sentence. It's more a title for the book, I think. Matthew begins chapter 1, verse 1. The book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. In this first verse, Matthew, like Mark, makes a confession of who this one Jesus is. This is the Christ, the Messiah. So there is a confession there. But then we find a difference. Mark didn't talk about Jesus as the son of David and the son of Abraham. Here in the first chapter, the first verse, Matthew right away is bringing to the foreground the two of the most important historic figures in the history of Israel, King David and Abraham, the one with whom, along with Sarah, God made the covenant. What Matthew is doing here, in contrast to Mark, is developing a theme of continuity. And that's a major theme that we find over and over again in the Gospel of Matthew. There's continuity here in the life and person of Jesus Christ with what has come before. Jesus is the fulfillment of what has come before. And we find in Matthew many, many references back. This was to fulfill what the prophet said. This was to fulfill what the writer wrote. That occurs so much more in Matthew than in Mark. And it's this theme of continuity, Jesus as fulfillment of the Hebrew Scriptures. So right away at the beginning, we get one of the major themes introduced in the Gospel of Matthew. To underscore, then, this idea of continuity, Matthew first offers a genealogy. We found no genealogy in Mark at all. Mark begins not with birth narratives, but with Jesus' baptism. The other gospel writer who includes a genealogy is Luke. And if you'll notice, first of all, about Matthew's genealogy is that it begins with Abraham. It carries Jesus' name and line back to Abraham. In the second verse of the first chapter, Matthew begins there. Luke, in the third chapter, the 23rd verse and following, develops a different scheme for a genealogy. Luke's and Matthew's genealogies are quite different in the names that they include. There are some similarities, many differences. And Luke takes this genealogy of Jesus back to Adam, we find in verse 38, the Son of God. That's the place that Luke is wanting to take the story of Jesus. We'll study that one more on Thursday. One of the interesting things to note about it, just on the surface, is that Luke has a reputation for being, I guess, one of the most inclusive of the Gospels, especially as far as women are concerned. In Luke's genealogy, there are no women mentioned at all. It's all men in Luke's genealogy. Matthew, in contrast, is doing a different thing with this genealogy, taking it back to Abraham. Just to stop briefly in Mark before we get to Matthew again, Mark includes no birth narrative at all. And I think the main reason for that is that Mark is wanting to emphasize the importance of our birth and baptism. That's where Jesus' birth that counts really lies in the Gospel of Mark. Not back in some human birth, but in the birth in baptism. And so that's one of the reasons, I think, why Mark includes no birth narratives and no accounts of Jesus up to the time he's called to his ministry in his baptism. But Matthew takes a different tack and includes a genealogy. So let's look at that in our first part of this session together. It's a genealogy that is dominated by male names. We notice that right away. Abraham is the father of Isaac, Isaac the father of Jacob, Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers. No mentions here of the great matriarchs in the Israelite tradition. No mention of Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, Leah, none of those prominent women of the matriarchal and patriarchal period at all in Israel are mentioned. So there's one omission that's important to note. But then in the third verse, we come to something different. A woman is mentioned, and Judah, the father of Perez and Zerah, by Tamar. And Tamar is the first woman that is mentioned in this genealogy, and we see that in contrast to Luke's genealogy, Matthew is going to include women. So why is Tamar there? Why not Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, these more prominent women of the Hebrew Scripture stories? Why Tamar? Well, let's look briefly at her story. I don't know how familiar it is. Matthew includes other women too, and some of their stories are more familiar, but Tamar's story is not a very familiar story, and so I'll develop that briefly for you. It's recorded in the 38th chapter of Genesis, and it takes up pretty much the whole chapter, so we won't read it. But suffice it to say that Judah is Tamar's father-in-law. Judah marries a non-Israelite woman, the daughter of Shua, a Canaanite, we read in the 38th chapter. And three sons come out of this marriage, Onan, and Shelah. The eldest, marries Tamar, the woman who appears in Matthew's genealogy, also a non-Israelite. And he is wicked, and so he dies, and Tamar is left a widow. In that time, there was the practice of levirate marriage ensued. And levirate marriage. And what that meant is that if the husband of a woman died, it was the duty of her brother-in-law then to marry her. And especially if there was no offspring from the first marriage, the firstborn son of that subsequent marriage would be considered the son of the dead brother. This was a way to continue the line. And Tamar had no children in this story, and so it's the duty now of Onan, the second brother, to marry this sister-in-law of his. Well, he does that. He's dutiful to that point, but he goes into her to conceive a child, and Onan wants nothing to do with that because he wants a son for himself. He doesn't want to provide his dead brother a son, first of all, and so he spills his seed. And this is where the word Onanism comes from. The sin of Onan is to spill his seed. And there is no child that results from the union. So God's seeing this slays Onan. So Tamar is twice a widow. And what to do? Well, there's a third brother, Shelah. But he's too young to marry her. And so Judah, her father-in-law, tells her to go back to her father's house and wait for Shelah to grow up so that she can marry him and have a son. The patience of women in that time is remarkable, I think. So Tamar does that. She goes back. And it seems that Judah forgets about her or chooses to forget about her. She never hears from him. So she takes matters into her own hands. And she dresses up when she hears that her father-in-law is coming into the neighborhood. She dresses up as a cult prostitute, a woman in the service of the goddess Ishtar of the Canaanite religion. Judah, this patriarch of Israel, comes and sees this cult prostitute and goes into her and wants to have sexual relations with her. Well, she says, okay, first of all, I want you to give me your cord, your signet, and your staff. And that's sort of like today asking for a person's credit card, driver's license, and passport. Those were things that were very important in Israelite time. He gives these to her, and then they have sexual relations together. He leaves, and Tamar becomes pregnant through that union. Judah hears this, and he's incensed. His daughter-in-law has been playing the harlot and gotten herself pregnant. And then, as she's being dragged out to be burned, Tamar sends these signet, cord, and staff back to Judah. And he has a moment of revelation and realizes that he is the one who was being unfaithful to Tamar, not Tamar being unfaithful. And he realizes that he is the father of this child. And in fact, it turns out to be two sons, Perez and Zerah. Twins are born of that union. So you can see that with mentioning Tamar's name, the writer of the Gospel of Matthew is dragging out some dirty laundry, I think you could call it, in the history of Israel, this story, and presenting this story of Tamar through the mention of her name. There are three themes that we find in this story that become significant. The theme of adultery or harlotry, that's one of the characteristics of Tamar and what her name would connote. Also, we find clever, courageous acts on the part of this woman. She takes matters into her own hands finally and does a very daring thing to force the issue. And then thirdly, she's an outsider, a Canaanite woman. And those are three significant things that emerge about Tamar. We go along then, and there are more men who are mentioned. And then in the fifth verse, we come to the second woman who appears in Matthew's genealogy. And Salmon, the father of Boaz, by Rahab. Rahab's story is also perhaps not so well known. It's told in the second and sixth chapters, especially of the book of Joshua. And I'll just briefly relate it. Rahab is a harlot in the city of Jericho. That's how she is introduced in the second chapter of Joshua. The Israelites are outside the city of Jericho seeking to overtake it. And so two spies come in to the city and go to Rahab's house. They're being pursued by their enemy soldiers. Rahab sees them and she hides them on the roof of her house under flax that she lays across the top of the roof. The enemy soldiers come, search the house, don't find these two Israelite spies. And Rahab then releases them when their enemy disappears. She then makes a deal with them. Because I've hidden you, will you protect me when you Israelite people take over the city, is the bargain that she drives with them. They agree to that, and when the Israelites eventually take over the city of Jericho, Rahab and her whole family are saved and spared and integrated into the Israelite family because of her bravery and her goodwill toward these two spies. Again, think of the three themes that we saw with Tamar. Rahab also is a harlot. She is clever and courageous as she hides these two Israelite spies from their enemy soldiers. And she is an outsider, a woman of Jericho, not an Israelite. We go along, and in that fifth verse, another woman is introduced. And Boaz, the father of Obed, by Ruth. Now, Ruth's story is probably the best known of the women who are mentioned in this genealogy of Matthew. We find her having in common several of these characteristics. She, too, is an outsider, a Moabite woman, like Rahab and Tamar. She is widowed in Moab and returns to Israel with her mother-in-law, Naomi. And through their clever and courageous acts, they get a husband for Ruth, Boaz. And so there are two characteristics that she shares, outsider, and she and her mother-in-law show themselves to be clever and courageous as they pursue a husband for Ruth. What to do then about the adultery or the harlotry pattern that we've seen with the first two? Well, let's turn to the book of Ruth, the third chapter, and see what we can find in this story. It goes Joshua judges Ruth, it's just a short book in the Old Testament there. The third chapter. Naomi and Ruth come to the land of Israel, and this practice of levirate marriage is still in effect. Ruth's husband has died, she's a widow, and so whom should she marry? The brother of her dead husband has also died, so there are no immediate males in the family for her to marry, so then the levirate practice says you go to the next of kin. Well, there are two next of kin, one man who is not named in the story of Ruth, and then there is Boaz, who is the next of kin, sort of. So those would be the two eligible men for Ruth to marry. And he doesn't come forward offering himself. So Ruth and Naomi plan how to catch this Norwegian bachelor farmer, sort of. And they're very subtle and clever and courageous as they go about doing that. The story climaxes in the third chapter, this pursuit of Boaz, with Naomi's plan for her daughter-in-law. Ruth is to go out into Boaz's fields where the men will be drinking and making merry after a hard day's work. And then this is what's going to happen in verse 6. So Ruth went down to the threshing floor and did just as her mother-in-law had told her. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, He went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. And perhaps we can picture this as a pile of grain, and Boaz is sleeping a bit of ways away from other people sleeping. So there's a bit of privacy there. Then Ruth came softly and uncovered his feet and lay down. What's going on here? It's a little hard to understand. She uncovers his feet. What does that mean? Perhaps she literally uncovered his feet, and that then would be enough to force his hand. But one of the interesting things about the word feet in the Hebrew language is that it's also a euphemism for male genitalia. And perhaps that's what Ruth uncovers here in this midnight encounter in the dark at the end of the pile of grain. If that's the case, it would put Ruth's story in this line of this pattern that we've been developing with Tamar and Rahab, who were played the harlot, both of them. Ruth is not playing the harlot here, but there is some sexual irregularity or misconduct going on that would keep her in the pattern of these two other women also. The Hebrew language is full of puns. It's an earthy language, an earthy story. And so I prefer that reading, although I will say it's debatable and not clear cut. So in verse 9, we find Boaz, or in verse 8, at midnight, the man woke up, startled, and turned over, and behold, a woman lay at his feet. And he said, "Who are you?" And she answered, "I am Ruth, your maidservant. Spread your skirt," which is the Hebrew word also for wings, "over your maidservant, for you are next of kin." Ruth comes and reminds him of his duty through levirate marriage. And it's at that point then that Boaz says, "Okay, I will see to my duty. Stay here with me tonight." There's no suggestion that they had sexual intercourse that night, but Ruth stays with him through the night, and the next morning he goes to town and follows through on his duty as the nearest of kin. So that's how Ruth fits into these themes of the women that we've been developing.
Ruth was one of the women who was studied in the women's Bible study this year. And one of the things that it pointed out there very definitely was the fact when Ruth and Naomi first got back, the first field that Ruth went into to glean was belonged to Boaz.
Yeah.
And they made this contact immediately.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, the women made the contact, but Boaz didn't follow through. You know, he would have known his duty for levirate marriage, but he didn't follow through right away. So the women are aggressors in this story. Yeah. So we go on then in the genealogy, Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, and we encounter then a fourth woman in this genealogy of Matthew. In the sixth verse, "And David was the father of Solomon by the wife of Uriah." This woman is interesting. She's not named by her own name. She is named by the name, the wife of Uriah. So let's explore why that happens and explore why she's included. Her story is told about in 2 Samuel 11, if you'd like to see that. I'll just relate it briefly. The name of this woman is Bathsheba, and which will maybe clarify who she is for you. And it's interesting that Matthew doesn't call her Bathsheba, but he calls her the wife of Uriah. And that name used for her here underscores the scandal associated with her, I think. Instead of calling her Bathsheba, calling her the wife of Uriah underlines the scandal associated with her, and let's see what that is. You perhaps are familiar with this story. David, King David, is out walking on the top of his roof, and he sees a woman bathing on a nearby roof. The story tells us he sees her, and she is very beautiful. He's attracted to her, and so he inquires about who she is. He finds out that her name is Bathsheba. It's told to him that she is the wife of Uriah the Hittite, who is one of his soldiers who is off fighting his wars. And so knowing all that information, David still calls her to come to him, and they have sexual intercourse together. So here's the first theme of adultery that we find in the women in Matthew. From that sexual union, she becomes pregnant, and she sends word to David that she's pregnant. So now the king is in a jam. What to do? So David shrewdly calls back Uriah from the front. This soldier will come back, he'll sleep with his wife, and then they'll think that the baby is Uriah's, and David will be out of the mess. Well, Uriah comes back, and it's a rule in Israel that when a soldier is fighting wars, he does not come near a woman. He does not sleep with a woman. And Uriah comes back from the front, and he turns out to be a more just man than this King David, this one Uriah the Hittite. He's an outsider, but he is just, and he does not sleep with his wife. He sleeps outside on the front stoop of his house, so all the town would see that he wasn't sleeping with Bathsheba and know that they hadn't had relationships. So David sees this and realizes that this isn't going to solve his jam. So the next time he gets Uriah drunk, thinking that in a drunken stupor he'll forget his justice and go into his wife. But Uriah, and this is one of the wonderful ironies of the story, even deadly drunk, is a more just man than King David and does not go into his wife. And so this isn't going to solve David's problem. So what does he do but send Uriah back to the front to fight? And he makes sure that David makes sure by telling one of his generals to have Uriah killed. And that's how David makes sure that this problem gets taken care of. Uriah is killed at the front through David's orders. And so in this tragic story, Uriah the Hittite, this outsider in Israel, is shown to be a more just man than the king of Israel, this King David. David then, with Uriah dead, takes Bathsheba to be his wife. A baby is born, and the baby dies. But after they grieve that death, the story tells us they conceive another child together, who is Solomon, one of the kings of Israel. So that's the story in brief of the wife of Uriah. There is the theme of adultery. There is the theme of outsider. We don't know if Bathsheba was also a Hittite. The story doesn't tell us, but she is married to a Hittite. And so that gives her a connection with that outsider theme that we see with these three women. She is more passive in the story. We don't see her doing aggressive, clever acts like the other women that we've looked at in Matthew's genealogy. But there is a quiet courage that we see in this one Bathsheba in the story as she loses a husband and a child through the hand of David. So all these women are associated with some sort of dubious sexual conduct. They are outsiders, and they display courage, some very clever. Why are these women included in Matthew's genealogy? And what does this tell us about what Matthew is about? I think the first thing we can say perhaps about this is that these women are included in Matthew's genealogy perhaps to justify the irregularity of Jesus' birth. These women are all associated with some sexual irregularity, and so is Jesus, this one born of a virgin, betrothed to a man. How to explain that? That's a very odd, irregular thing in the story. And so to account for the irregularity of Jesus' birth, Matthew here is raising up other irregularities in the story of Israel and saying, in this theme of continuity that we see in Matthew, Matthew is saying there's a continuity here. This has happened, things like this have happened before, and God has worked through them in Israel. And just so, God will be working through this virgin birth. That's perhaps one reason why these women are included in Matthew's genealogy. They're included also perhaps to prepare the readers of this gospel for the radical story that's to come, a story that tells of good news for all people. That might also be another reason that Matthew includes them. This story is not just for righteous insiders, but this story is for all. And it's been for all in the past, too. I think that's another thing Matthew is undergirding here. This isn't necessarily a new thing. A third reason that these women could be included in this genealogy is to underscore the idea that God works through unlikely vessels. We might want to think that God works through the great patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Sarah, Rachel, and Rebecca, and Leah. But God works also through unlikely vessels, Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, the wife of Uriah, people like that. There will be things about Jesus, Matthew is saying here, I think, that will look unlikely. There will be things about Jesus' followers that seem unlikely, that make them unlikely vessels. But God has worked through such people in the past, and God will now work through them in this gospel story. So those are some of the reasons that I can think of that these women, these particular women, when there were so many to choose from, why these particular women would be included in a genealogy like Matthew's. Are there comments or questions that you'd like to make at this point?
Are all the men in the genealogy Israelites?
To my knowledge, they are, yes. I haven't studied them in such detail as I have the women. It's my next project. But
You mentioned something about the patriarchs, the men, the good guys. Well, every one of them was a rat at some time.
I know, that's right. That's right.
Through that, by asking for forgiveness and turning their lives back to God and asking Him to direct them. Mm-hmm. And giving up their rotten lifestyles and things, he forgave them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they fell again.
Yeah, I know. That's a pattern over and over again. Yeah, that's true. But there are women with better reputations that could have been chosen than these. So, yeah, that's a good point. What we can say next about women in this gospel. Mary, then, is the fifth woman who appears in this genealogy. And we find her in the last verse, in verse 16. And Jacob, the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom Jesus was born, who is called Christ. One of the things to note is that the genealogy is not figured through Mary. It's through Joseph. And so even though Joseph wasn't the biological father of Jesus, he is the one who establishes the lineage for Jesus, shows the patriarchy of the time in how births were arranged and figured. But Mary is mentioned, and which she is not in Luke. Luke doesn't mention her at all. It's the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, not the wife of Joseph. And so she has a rather prominent role here in this genealogy, of whom Jesus was born, who is called Christ. Women having such a prominent introduction in the genealogy, it's amazing in a way that they're included at all, especially when you compare this genealogy to Luke, which includes no women at all, that Matthew could have done that. With such a prominent beginning spot in the book, women then moved to a very marginalized spot in the Gospel of Matthew until the end. Mary retreats from the story. The story in chapters 1 and 2, and Matthew goes on to tell the birth story of Jesus. And the stories that we know so well about Mary and Elizabeth are found in Luke. Matthew instead focuses on Joseph. Mary is a very minor figure, appearing only three brief times where she's just mentioned in Matthew's account of the birth of Jesus. Instead, it's Joseph who is the prominent one. The way I understand that is that, again, Matthew is wanting to show this theme of continuity with the past. Joseph is the one who is Jesus' ancestor through whom the lineage is figured, so he takes a prominent role. And also, I think Matthew is drawing some connections between this Joseph, who has two dreams in these first two chapters of Matthew, and Joseph, one of the great patriarchs of Israel, who was also a dreamer and through whom God worked in mighty ways in the Hebrew scripture story. And so Matthew, again, is wanting to stress the continuity here and doing that by developing stories with Joseph as the major figure instead of Mary.
And also the out of Egypt.
They're out of Egypt, yes.
Mm-hmm. Story.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In verse 19 and following, yeah, where they are connected with Egypt.
In 2:15, this is to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet out of Egypt.
Right, have I called my son? Yeah, that's right. So Joseph really has three dreams, even in these first two chapters. There are the next 20 chapters in Matthew contain some stories of women. They have stories of anonymous women, and they are, for the most part, all of the stories that we looked at yesterday in the Gospel of Mark about anonymous women. Matthew, in the 8th chapter, tells the story of Simon's mother-in-law, who remains anonymous in Matthew 2. In the 9th chapter, there is the story of the ruler's daughter who was healed, comparable to the story of Jairus' daughter in Mark. There is the story of the woman with the flow of blood in chapter 9. And then in chapter 26, there is the story of the woman anointing Jesus. But those are the four stories of women in the Gospel of Matthew. Matthew drops even the 5th story that we saw in Mark, the story of the widow with two coins, who in the temple that was included in Mark is not included in Matthew. So the 5 stories of anonymous women that we saw in Mark become 4 stories in Matthew. And what we find also is that Matthew adds no new material about other women in this gospel. What we find instead is that Matthew includes the stories that we found that we didn't look at really, but that are in Mark of anonymous men and men with names. Matthew uses those, and then Matthew includes many, many more stories of men, anonymous and named. I was trying to count them up last night around 1 o'clock, so I don't know how accurate this count is, but I came up with 19 healing miracle stories involving Jesus and people like the anonymous women and men. And 4 of those are of women. So that leaves 15, which are stories of Jesus and a man or men. And at least half of those are new to Matthew, added from Mark's stories. And so the balance is different in Matthew from Mark. In Mark, there was much more equal balance between the stories of anonymous women and anonymous or named men. And in Matthew, as I was reading it again last night, women are quite marginalized and overwhelmed in a way by all the stories that we find of Jesus' encounters with men. They are there, but they're not as prominent. I've entitled this talk, Looking On From Afar. And I'm using that in a metaphoric way to describe women in Matthew. The women in the genealogy are women from afar. You know, they're foreign women. They're women with dubious sexualities. And in that sense, they're women from afar. And then as we move into the story of Matthew, again, women are looking on from afar. They're not as prominent or present as we found in the Gospel of Mark. Also, another theme that Matthew picks up, that's developed in Mark, is this theme of the disciples. And we looked at that in detail yesterday in Mark. We'll look at that briefly in Matthew to see what Matthew does with it. We have all these 19 encounters with mostly anonymous people in the Gospel of Mark, in the Gospel of Matthew. And then in the midst of all those stories, in the 10th chapter, the 12 disciples are named by name in the Gospel of Matthew. That's the first time it's delayed in Matthew. That's the first time that they get their names. And then we see the disciples and their encounters with Jesus. The dynamic that we looked at yesterday in Mark was that the disciples would see Jesus do something or hear him say something and they wouldn't get it. Over and over again, that was the pattern that we saw in Mark. We see that in Matthew to a certain extent. In the 8th chapter, for instance, Jesus comes to them in a boat, or Jesus is in the boat with them and calms the storm. And the disciples in Matthew marvel, what sort of man is this? Just like they asked in Mark, who then is this? But more often in Matthew, the disciples struggle to get it and then get it. We see that in chapter 13, for instance. If you'll turn to that with me. In the 10th verse of the 13th chapter, we find Jesus being asked by the disciples, why do you speak to the people in parables? And with that kind of innocent question, Jesus goes on for 40 verses to explain why he speaks to these people in parables. And it's it can be almost comical the way the disciples ask this question. You've had the experience of asking a question, and then the person responds to it for an hour long, you know, when you wanted a one-minute response. Well, that's sort of the way the 13th chapter in Matthew feels to me. And Jesus goes on for 40 verses to explain and to tell more parables. And then in the 51st verse, he says to these disciples who have listened to all of this, have you understood all this? Jesus says to them, and they say to him, yes. No, we never would have gotten that encounter in the Gospel of Mark. But that's a pattern that we find repeated now again several times in the Gospel of Matthew. We find it again in the 16th chapter. Where the disciples are struggling to understand the bread story that we looked at in Mark yesterday, where the disciples, Jesus says to them, beware the leaven of the Pharisees, and then they go out in a boat, and the disciples say, but we have no bread. And Jesus says, do you not yet understand? Well, at the end of this story in Matthew, we read in verse 12, then they understood. They do understand in Matthew. Again, in the 17th chapter, verse 13, after the transfiguration, in Mark, there's no understanding on the part of the disciples. Here in Matthew, there is understanding. So Matthew is developing these disciples in a different way. A theme that we saw again in Mark was this concern on the part of the disciples for their own power and prestige. Matthew includes that, but dilutes it. And let's look just briefly at two places where we can see that, and it serves then to work in an interesting way. In Mark, the 9th chapter, we saw yesterday how Jesus had told his disciples twice about what his work as Messiah was to be. The disciples didn't get it, and so they asked him instead, who is going to be the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? And the placement for that in the 9th chapter of Mark makes it very much seem like a question concerned about the disciples' own importance. Am I one of the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? Matthew has the disciples asking the same question in the 18th chapter, the first verse, but the placement of that question makes it a general question. We read at the beginning of the 18th chapter, at that time the disciples came to Jesus saying, who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? Not so much a personal question, but just a broad general question. Let's get this one on the table and explore it, is the sense of it in Matthew. It dilutes that issue that we found in Mark. When the issue comes up again in the 20th chapter of Matthew, it's like it's a almost verbatim the same story that we found in Mark, where the two disciples, the sons of Zebedee, come to Jesus and say, can we sit one on your right and one on your left hand? Here in Matthew, that same question is asked, but it's not the sons of Zebedee who ask, but the mother of the sons, which again serves to dilute the disciples' concern for their own person and prestige. You pin it on mom in Matthew instead. Matthew 20:20, she's the one asking the question. So the disciples in Matthew seem less concerned about their own position and power than they did in the Gospel of Mark. We find much more in Matthew examples of disciples who understand. They struggle to know, and then they get it. They get it like the anonymous women and men in Matthew's gospel also get it. So there's not so much the contrast that we found in Mark between the named disciples and the anonymous women. That's not so much a theme at all in the Gospel of Matthew. Here the disciples are like the anonymous women and men, and we have much more this scheme of people struggling to get it and getting it in Matthew. This theme then is developed finally at the end of the gospel, and let's look at that, the 27th chapter, where, as in Mark, women have been pretty much unnamed in the Gospel of Matthew. They're this prominent place where they're named at the beginning of the gospel, and then for the most part, they are anonymous and kind of marginalized in the gospel until the 27th chapter, when women get names in the 55th verse. And there were also many women there looking on from afar who had followed Jesus from Galilee, ministering to him. So a lot of anonymous women, and then three are named, among whom were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Joseph, and the mother of the sons of Zebedee. Different threesome than we found in Mark. It's two of those women, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary, who go the next morning in the 28th chapter, or go not the next morning, but the next morning after that, to the sepulcher. It's a little different again from Mark. They find not a young woman there, but an angel of the Lord, who is like lightning as he appears to them. He tells them, "Don't be afraid, Jesus is risen. Go and tell this news to the disciples." In verse 8 in Mark, we saw the women leaving in fear and trembling and silence. In verse 8 of Matthew's story, we find them instead departing quickly from the tomb with fear and great joy, and they ran to tell the disciples. These women are faithful. They hear the news and they get it. They understand what they're to do. This is the theme of discipleship that is developed in Matthew, and the named women at the end follow that pattern. Then in verse 9, a wonderful moment, Jesus appears, the first post-resurrection appearance to these women running to tell the good news. And he then also instructs them to go and tell. And they do go and tell, because we read in verse 16 that the 11 disciples appear on the mountain and receive the final words from Jesus. The women disappear from the story at that point, and Matthew concludes with these 11 disciples and Jesus on the mountain. So, again, in contrast to Mark, women in Matthew are like the male disciples. They get it. They're told what to do. They're told what Jesus is about. There might be a bit of struggle, but they understand. One of the major things we can say about that, I think, is that in the end, Mark stresses more the power of God in all of this. Disciples don't understand. We fail as disciples. We're silent when we should speak. We're fearful when we should be bold. And it's only by the power of God that the story got told, because these disciples didn't do it. But God continues to work in Mark through such failed disciples. There's a different stress in Matthew, finally. There is much more a sense that we have a response in all this, and we can make a response. Disciples are seen as able to understand and respond faithfully in the Gospel of Matthew. Yeah?
He really throws us a curve, though, right at the very end, when they're up there saying bye-bye to Jesus. Mm-hmm. In verse 17, mm-hmm. And they saw him and they worshiped him.
But some doubted.
So that actually, in the last analysis, he comes clean, saying that maybe they were BSing a little bit whenever they said, "Yeah, we understand what you're saying," and lean more in the direction of the guys as they appear in Mark.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this is where Matthew, and this is a huge generalization, but if we can talk about Matthew, Mark, and Luke, those the three synoptic gospels, Mark is one that is a very ironic tale where there's lots of doubt and mystery and people don't get it. Matthew, or Luke, on the other hand, is almost a romance at the end. Everybody gets it at the end of Luke, and they go back to Jerusalem praising God in the temple, waiting for the Spirit to come. It's really almost a romantic story, the way it ends there. Matthew is sort of someplace in between. Many of the disciples get it and are faithful and follow Jesus. But then there's this bit of reality almost that comes in with that bit verse, and some doubted.
That's kind of helpful, I think.
Okay.
To realize that even throughout the whole gospel, they're riding on a train. And then at the end, they wonder where the train is going.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Some of them. Anyway.
Yeah. There's room for that.
There's
in
room
Matthew's
for all of us.
Scheme. Yeah. Uh-huh. If we line ourselves up with the doubters, there is room for us. Yeah, Dan.
I've heard it said that you could, like, one way of approaching the Gospels is thinking about who the audience was that the writer was trying to proclaim, and that, for example, Luke with going all the way back to Adam is preaching to Gentiles too, and that Matthew is really writing for a Jewish audience, and would that, because of the place of women in Jewish society, and I like your continuity theme of that would be more palatable to keep women kind of
second
class.
Yeah, that question came up at the session with the staff this morning, and I was struggling to know what to do with it, so I took a walk down to the bridge and back, and it occurred to me, and this is interesting to me, I don't know how much I can support it, but Mark is another gospel that we can perhaps argue was written for a Jewish audience. Matthew also written for a Jewish audience. Mark is radical in the way it stresses discontinuity, this new thing that's happening, and the amazing stuff that Mark does with the prominent anonymous women and the women's role at the end. Mark is like a story that was willing to really push the establishment. Matthew is a story also to a Jewish audience that is a more conservative story, I would argue, and to maybe a similar kind of audience, but taking the conservative road rather than the more radical road. Stressing the continuity. This is in our story. This is in our past. It's not something to be afraid of or put off by, maybe. This is who we are, even, would be a way that I would characterize Matthew. And I was feeling a bit apologetic at the staff Bible study this morning because of women's role in the gospel, and I decided on my walk that rather than feeling apologetic, I'm going to marvel that there's as much as there is in Matthew, considering the conservative kind of gospel that it seems to be, and not just in the way it treats women, but in many other themes also. And so it's remarkable, it's a radical thing Matthew's doing, given this community, to include those five women in that genealogy, and to have women being the recipients of the good news and the faithful disciples at the end. So rather than apologizing or feeling like we got a bum deal from Matthew, I should perhaps be rejoicing that women are as much there as they are. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't think anybody needs to apologize for God's word.
Yeah. I know.
Sometimes I get, when I'm not too charitable towards Matthew, I get to think that he actually was grinding an axe in it. And maybe a true son of Levi who would arise in the morning and say, above all else, I thank you that I was not created a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And praise God that he was a male. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I wonder if that doesn't really come through and smack a little bit on some of these, that he maybe even puts the women of questionable character in. The thing that really hooks me is the James and John story, where Mark has the two guys coming themselves, but Matthew has the good Jewish mother coming into the to the corporate executive and say, let this one be the president and this one the chairman of the board. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's pure speculation, but if Matthew is the Jew's Jew, there could be some of that. I don't know if it takes away anything from the value of the gospel account. I don't mean to say that.
Yeah.
But it's possible that this was just a little zing here and there that Matthew
threw. Yeah. That would be another angle on it. I'm taking a softer approach, I guess, and a more optimistic approach. Matthew does also include two sets of paired parables. Luke has many more, a parable about a man and a parable about a woman. And those have been sometimes used to talk about Luke's audience as being more women in it, and Luke writing more for the women in his audience also. Here's a parable about the lost sheep. What man of you having a sheep? What woman of you having a coin? We'll see that in Luke on Thursday. Matthew does stick two tiny little parables in there, which makes me, I guess, feel like I would not perhaps want to be as harsh to Matthew. It's tentative little things that Matthew's throwing out there that perhaps were quite radical for that community. In 13:31 and 33, there's two parables about the kingdom of heaven. One, a man taking a grain of mustard seed and planting it, and it grows big, and a woman with leaven, putting leaven in the bread. And then in the 24th chapter, the 40th verse, there's two men in the field. One is taken, one is left. And there's two women grinding at the mill. One is taken and one is left. That's all that Matthew has in the paired parables. But it's like a tentative step in that direction, which is perhaps another thing that I would put on the table to support a less harsh view. But I think you could, you know, see Matthew that way too. There would be good support for that.
Well, just reading on there, the parable of the ten maidens. Mm-hmm. I mean, here you've got women who were faithful.
Yeah.
Who get it.
Five of them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. And that parable, again, is unique to Matthew. That's the one other parable that he includes that has women in it.
Margaret Thatcher in the Wall Street Journal a couple of years ago said, you know, it's the rooster who crows, but it's the hen who lays the egg.
Do you want to comment further about that?
Let it lie,
huh? Well, we have just a few more minutes. Are there questions or concluding comments?
Yesterday, you picked up the themes in Mark about anonymity and servant leadership, and Matthew not only dilutes that, as she said, but I noticed that Matthew, the Gospel of Matthew generally, is very concerned with questions about authority and the disciples having a much more prominent place and in hierarchical leadership. And is there like a generational difference between Mark and Matthew? And are we seeing the beginning of a more established church organization here, and maybe that's part of the struggle that Matthew is addressing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that could be. Yeah. I to tell you the truth, I haven't studied so much the communities to which these gospels are written, so I'm on shakier ground when I try to do that. The way I can infer it is
I do mostly a literary reading of these texts, as you can tell, and so as I try to infer a reader for this, that's how I do it. I haven't studied it historically yet much. And so, yeah, I could infer that from reading Matthew, that there's a more organized church now. And we saw those issues beginning in Mark. Can I sit on your right? Can I sit on your left hand? Some of those issues of authority and position and power are there, and Mark addresses those very firmly, that this is not what we're about. Matthew is perhaps another generation, because it's almost a given here. We can't do without it, so then how are we going to live with it is more the sense that I find in Matthew of authority.
You know, the missing piece in all of this for me is I'm left with a real sense of loss, wondering what a woman would have written as a gospel mm-hmm. in that time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's where the silent women at the end of Mark are very poignant to me, because it's that silence that pervades the gospels. We the women are silent. We don't know their stories in the way that we know the stories of the men.
It's a conglomeration of differences that makes life interesting.
Yeah. So, well, with that, let's thank you for coming and